This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And we start today just north of Massachusetts in the Granite State, where New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu last week announced his plan to gradually reopen much of the state's economy. Now, with Massachusetts still at least a few weeks away from its own gradual reopening, that poses interesting learning opportunities and coordination challenges. For more, we're joined by Hadley Barndollar, reporter for the Portsmouth Herald and Seacoast Online. Hadley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So, Hadley, tell us, what is the plan that Governor Sununu announced last Friday?
So last Friday, here in New Hampshire, our governor announced a modified stay-at-home order that he's calling Stay-at-Home 2.0. That's currently in effect until May 31st. Despite this stay-at-home order, industries are going to be opening sooner in New Hampshire than they are in Massachusetts and Maine, for example. Things are really going to ramp up over the next 2 weeks, where we'll start to see things like retail and outdoor dining begin to reopen with restrictions. Sununu's calling it a phased approach to reopening the economy, and it has been endorsed by the governor's Economic Reopening Task Force. But really, over the next 2 weeks is when we're going to start to see large sectors of our economy begin to reopen.
So I want to ask you, is it based on the same kind of data, this decision, as Governor Baker is using here in Massachusetts? For example, Governor Baker says we have to have 14 days of downward trends on key data points. Has that happened in New Jersey? I'm sorry, New Hampshire. Sorry
That's about okay. That. That's okay. Yes, I mean, Sununu continues to tout that all the decisions are being made in accordance with the state epidemiologist and DHHS. We have begun to see some days of more downward projections, but I wouldn't say yet we've reached consistently seeing less and less cases each day. So far, the number of confirmed cases right now in New Hampshire is 2,588, and we've had 86 residents die from the virus. Numbers over the weekend of new confirmed cases were 164, 121. Yesterday was in the 70s. So, I mean, we're starting to see a little bit of a downward trend, but not consistent just yet.
What's the reaction across the state to this plan for a gradual reopening?
I think you have parts of the population that are tired of staying at home, and they're starting to push the envelope a little bit, while others feel strongly that reopening things too soon could have a major impact on infection rates and possibly rewind our progress. I think the general consensus is obviously everybody wants to get back to work, but it has to be safe and financially feasible to reopen.
How big has the impact been on the New Hampshire economy over these last several weeks?
It's been pretty significant. Obviously, the unemployment numbers, you know, just like in every other state, are nothing like we have ever seen before. I'm currently residing in Portsmouth and downtown Portsmouth, which is usually, you know, so buzzing and busy during this time of year. It's been an absolute ghost town. So we've really been seeing our communities really trying to step up and help all of those that are out of work right now.
So, you know, Governor Sununu has talked on a number of occasions really about being concerned that folks from Massachusetts, especially the North Shore, are going to come on up and bring the virus. Is that a concern for business owners up there?
Certainly. And that's been a big point of conversation. The question becomes how New Hampshire, sandwiched between Massachusetts and Maine, which are both still on relatively strict stay-at-home orders, is going to grapple with certain industries being open and available here sooner and not in neighboring states. You know, many are concerned that will bring out out-of-staters to access services like retail shopping and outdoor dining. You know, the city of Portsmouth, for example, is really going to have a plan for Memorial Day weekend, being a top dining destination so accessible to both Massachusetts and Maine. And I think it's important to point out that Governor Sununu said that in order to reopen beaches, there would really have to be regional collaboration. But as far as reopening the economy, he clearly is stepping ahead of both Maine and Massachusetts.
And have you seen an uptick in Massachusetts license plates with the weather getting nicer?
We did report a story over the weekend that, you know, despite the beaches being shut down, there are Massachusetts license plates in Rye and Hampton and Northampton and Seabrook. You know, police are obviously doing their best for enforcement. But yes, we are starting to see more come up the coastline.
And Hadley, you did some reporting on a specific industry in all of this. Really interesting. You want to tell us about that briefly?
Yeah, we published a story yesterday on hair salons, which are currently given a reopening date of Monday, May 11th, so next Monday. And there had been a lot of concern in the New Hampshire beauty industry that they weren't receiving proper representation in front of the governor's economic reopening task force, which is alluded to in my reporting. So, after the reopening announcement was given on Friday, we put out a call on Facebook to area hair salons and barbers for this story. And I received more than 20 emails that all had the common theme of course, we want to go back to work, but we need to do it when it's safe and economically viable for our business. I'll quote one salon owner. As she told me, she feels like salons have two options. She said to me, "We keep our business closed and jeopardize losing our clientele to competing salons who are opening, or we open and put ourselves directly in harm's way." So I think it was clear, many salons had two major issues with the reopening plan. One being the continued preaching of, the importance of social distancing, yet this is an industry where stylists stand on top of their clients with their hands in their hair. The second one, many are concerned that only being allowed to offer limited services will put them in the red financially after they've paid rent, utilities, and their staff. It's been announced that only haircuts and single color root touch-ups will be allowed, not even blow drying. All the hair salons are telling people, you're going to leave the salon with wet hair, just so you know.
Yeah.
But
Well,
go ahead.
go ahead. No, finish your thought just briefly,
I
please.
was just going to say, that being said, there is a resounding pressure to reopen, because business owners feel if they don't, they're going to lose their clientele and, it'll ultimately be a nail in the coffin long term. I will say that the state continues to emphasize that the May 11th date is a choice to reopen, and those who choose not to reopen can continue to collect unemployment.
Well, lots of lessons for us to learn from New Hampshire. That's Hadley Barndollar, reporter for the Portsmouth Herald and Seacoast Online. Hadley, I appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
So the measures to control the spread of COVID-19 are having unprecedented consequences on our economy here in Massachusetts, and they may further exacerbate social inequities. So what will society look like when this pandemic ends? Tonight at 6, WBUR City Space will host a virtual town hall on the societal impacts of COVID-19. Host will be WBUR's Callum Borchers, and the guest is Dr. Sandro Galea of Boston University School of Public Health and Danielle Allen at Harvard Center for Ethics. To register for the event tonight at 6, visit radioboston.org. We know that certain people can be particularly susceptible to the coronavirus, for example, those who are immune compromised. But we don't know much yet about how the virus affects people who are pregnant and their babies. One can only imagine the concerns and anxieties with that. So today we want to talk about it. Join the conversation. Are you or have you been pregnant during this pandemic? What's that been like for you? What have been your concerns and how are you managing them? Do you have a loved one who's pregnant, a spouse, a partner? What are your concerns? What questions do you have about life after you give birth, given the current situation? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Joining us today is Dr. Anjali Kaimal, maternal fetal medicine specialist and obstetrician gynecologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she's also the chief of the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anika Butler also joins us, the ideas editor for the Boston Globe. She recently wrote an op-ed about being pregnant during the coronavirus pandemic. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Anika, I'm going to start with a couple questions for you. You're due in June. How has it been so far?
Oh my goodness, it's been a roller coaster. Of course, we didn't really know anything about the coronavirus until February, early March, so things were great until then. And as I wrote about in my op-ed in early March, I started to really get worried and panic as news spread that the virus was here in Boston. And so I've just been really worried and stressed about how it would affect not only giving birth, but our lives after that.
Anika, you wrote your op-ed in the Globe in March. And when one goes back and reads it now, it sounds like March. There were some things that you were focused on that maybe are a little bit differently now. But you were, as you say, really worried about whether you and your baby would be safe. Do you have the same worries now that you did when you wrote this in March? Do you have new worries? What are your concerns right now?
You know, that's a really great question. I actually feel a lot better about a lot of things now. And most, you know, I'm very lucky. I am a journalist, so I can work from home. I'm able to have things delivered to my house. And so now that I'm here in my safe little bubble, I'm so much less worried about getting sick myself or, you know, potentially exposing my baby to the coronavirus. So that those kinds of fears have gone away a bit. But I still am worried about what we're going to lose afterwards. I know the hospital where I'm giving birth is they've done this Mass General, they've done a lot to really prepare and make me feel comfortable about giving birth at the hospital. But once we get home, we won't have friends or family able to come by. We'll basically be on our own. There'll be no one to help us. You know, we missed out on things like baby shower, maternity photos, small things. But, you know, going forward, you know, how much longer will we need to be socially isolated? What will that do for my child's development? What if she doesn't meet another adult until she's, you know, 2 years old or 1 year old? Is that going to have long-term effects? And, you know, will her grandparents be able to travel here at some point? So those are the things that I worry about more now.
Listeners, join the conversation. What concerns do you have? What questions do you have? Do you have close family or friends who are going through a pregnancy now? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pull up a chair. Dr. Kimel, let me invite you first to just respond to what you heard from Anika.
So I think, you know, Anika was so eloquent in describing what I think has been all of our experience, right? It's been such a roller coaster during all of these times. And I think that we started off and we were very focused on some issues. And then now as things evolve, there are new things that come up and also things that we were worried about that we seem to be less concerned about, but then others that we know we need to put more attention towards. And so I agree. I think that, you know, so much of what has changed is about the experience of being a resident of Boston, of being a part of a family, whether that family is closer or far away, of understanding who are the people that can support us. And I think for pregnant women, all of those questions are really important. And I felt a little sad to hear you say, you know, that to give up on the baby shower and things like that, and that those are small things. I think, you know, obviously pregnancy and birth are such an important part of our lives. And the way that that experience has changed, even in those ways that are not us being ill or being at risk, like those things I think are really important. And I think also have implications kind of for mental health for all of us. So I think all of that really rings true with the things I'm hearing from the women that I'm taking care of. I'm glad to hear that you feel reassured by, I didn't know you were a Mass General patient until today. I'm glad to hear that you're reassured by the information we've given here. But I think there are lots of women who still do have questions about the course of their pregnancy and also their delivery. And so we're trying to get as much information to them as we can as we have it.
So Dr. Kimel, before I turn to calls, I do want to ask you just briefly, what do we know about how the virus affects pregnant women?
Yes. So this is obviously something that has been so rapidly evolving, not just about how it affects pregnant women, but how it affects the population in general. And I think back to, you know, as we were saying, March, when the thought was that we had, you know, about 80,000 people who had been infected in China, you know, things were just starting in Europe, and to now look at the situation with over 1 million people in the United States and how much that means that things are different. So I think we acknowledge that we have imperfect information and things are always evolving. I think so far what we've seen is that pregnant women seem to be at similar risk to the general population in terms of likelihood of getting coronavirus, and that the same kind of recommendations that we make for the general population to try and reduce the likelihood of infection work for pregnant ladies too. So all the things we were talking about, social distancing when we can, being able to wash our hands, being able to try to avoid, you know, touching surfaces and then touching your face, which is so hard to do. And so I think all of that has been reassuring to us to understand that women don't seem to be at more risk when they're pregnant. I think we're still trying to understand exactly how, if someone does get infected, how coronavirus affects affects them. It does seem just like in the regular population, when we have pregnant women who have other medical complications, diabetes, high blood pressure, that might put them at increased risk. The vast majority of women who get coronavirus when they're pregnant, similar to the regular population, have a relatively mild course or even asymptomatic. It's a very small percentage of people who need to be in the hospital and an even smaller percentage of people who need ICU level of care, but we are here to provide that care when it's needed. And then I think
the last question
is just that everyone wants to know, can my baby get infected? And so far, things have been very reassuring to say for pregnant women who have an infection during pregnancy, we don't think that that is a way that babies will get infected. So that's really good news.
All right, so Anika and Dr. Kimel, let's turn to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Kristen on the line from Burlington. Kristen, what's on your mind?
Hi. I am recently married, and my husband and I are hoping to start a family fairly soon. I'm wondering if it's worth trying to get pregnant now with this pandemic going on, or if we should kind of wait a few months and see how it goes, if it receives at all.
Kristen, stay right there, because Anika, you actually talk about this in the piece you wrote in March.
What
I'm thinking about is you and your husband sort of trying to plan it out, thinking you'd planned it all out right, had the right calculation, and then feeling differently.
Exactly. Yeah. We got pregnant via IVF. And so there was definitely a lot of planning that went into it over a couple of years, actually. And we thought we'd considered every possible factor that we could in the timing and, you know, our lives. And we definitely just did not think about that there was a possibility of a pandemic happening that could affect our pregnancy. So I think I just feel now that you just really can't plan for everything. And, you know, I think you just have to do what's right, what feels right for you.
Kristen, is that what you mean? Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about when you ask that question?
Yeah, I guess so. Definitely just, you know, that thought of like, what would I possibly be putting myself and this future child through, you know, if I get pregnant during a pandemic versus during a non-pandemic time?
Yeah. And Dr. Kimel, is there anything else you'd add to that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the idea that the time that is the right time to start a family is affected by so many different issues, I think, is definitely true. None of us, you know, could have ever predicted that the pandemic would be something that people would be dealing with. And I think that also means that while we don't expect that there's another event like this in the future, we don't know what the future holds. I think it's a really personal decision. In terms of the medical impact of coronavirus on pregnancy, I think, you know, the one thing is that at this point, we don't have a lot of information about, you know, ladies who are in the beginning part of pregnancy getting to delivery, because this has only been going on for a short period of time. And so while, like I said, we don't have anything to say that we are concerned about yet, I think we just do have imperfect information. And the same is true about what life is going to look like in 3 months or 6 months. And so I think that the way that those factors come into play in comparison to kind of where you are in your life and when it's time to start trying to have a baby, it's a complex interaction. And I think that's something too that if it's useful to talk to your doctors about, definitely that's something that we could certainly talk about based on individual circumstances.
I do have to say, I'm sorry, but it is really nice during this time of so much uncertainty to have something really positive to look forward to.
And I would say a lot of people feel that way. And certainly I feel that way when I'm on labor and delivery, that, you know, there's lots of things going on in the world, but that moment in that room is still that wonderful moment. So I think that's a great thing to point out.
Listeners, are there other questions that you have about choices about pregnancy, a pregnancy experience you're having now, being in the hospital during this time, the risks associated with birthing during this time? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anika, I was struck by you're having to forego the traditional baby shower. My children are in their late teens now, but I had some difficulties with my first pregnancy, couldn't travel home for my shower, and had a virtual baby shower actually at the time, which wound up being actually just an amazing experience, because all the women who would have come to the shower instead wrote me long letters with the best advice no one had ever given them about parenting and having babies. So it's actually one of my fondest memories from my first pregnancy. So one, I hope that gives you some encouragement But it also makes me want to ask you, what parts did you think you were going to get in this mothering experience during your pregnancy that you most are worried you won't get or miss that you aren't getting?
Well, I've had two virtual baby showers so far. I think there's going to be one more. So I have gotten to do that. And it was actually really great, because the part of baby showers that I don't like are the games. So there were no games and more just celebrating. So that actually was really nice. but it would have been nice to have people close by and to actually have that physical interaction. So I'm missing out on that. But there's just so much that is just so different from what I expected. We did a childbirth class online via Zoom, which was really weird. And infant child care class, you know, we were practicing changing diapers on a teddy bear because that was the closest thing we had to a model of a baby in our house. So, you know, we're hoping that these kinds of things are still going to prepare us. You know, maybe they will and maybe they won't, but it's just really different. And, you know, buying things for baby, it's, you know, I'm having to order them online and, you know, not really getting to go out. And so, I mean, it's not, they're not huge things. It's just really different from what I expected. But I think the thing that I feel like I'm missing most of all is just interacting with family and friends. And I know it's killing my sisters to not be able to see me while I'm pregnant and not be able to come right away when the baby is born. So that's really the hardest part, and just so much different than what I had hoped and planned for.
And do you feel ready to give birth?
I am so ready. I've got 5 weeks left, so I'm about at that point where I'm like, okay, come on. But no, I, you know, the giving birth, I do still worry a little bit. I mean, as I said before, I feel very comfortable about how Mass General is handling it. But my last doctor's appointment, I had to have my temperature taken, my name checked off a list, and was given a mask to wear while I was there. And I think no one else is allowed there but patients. And so I believe my husband will be allowed to be with me when I give birth, but we'll both be wearing masks. And that will be, you know, if you've been wearing masks outside, you know, they're hot and I'm a little uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to imagine going through labor, which is already uncomfortable and hot, wearing a mask. And so that makes me a little bit worried. That'll be challenging, but I'm ready.
I'm glad to hear that. And Dr. Kaimal, we've just heard from Anika a little bit about what she already understands about what the experience will be like once she checks in the hospital, but that can be a black box for people. Maybe you can briefly just walk us through what should a woman expect when going in to deliver right now?
For sure. And I think, you know, one thing that's important is that different hospitals have taken different approaches to this. So one, you definitely, this is one of those conversations that's really important to have with your obstetrician or your physician or your midwife to say, you know, what should I expect? What are the things I should know? Are there things that I should do beforehand? And I think that that's a conversation that we're hoping that we are initiating with women, but certainly as you're coming into those prenatal appointments or having a virtual visit, which is how we're doing some prenatal appointments, those are good questions to ask. So it is just as we were discussing that we're trying to really make sure that the hospital is as safe a place for the people who are here delivering babies as possible. And so part of that is that we are having everybody wear a mask. And the rest of the hospital, there are not visitors that are allowed in the hospital other than for very special circumstances, but birth is a special circumstance. And so you have one visitor who's with you. That person also wears a mask. So one thing is that we ask both the woman who's coming in and then also the partner or other support person if they are having any symptoms. And so that kind of screening happens as you're coming into the hospital. For women who have symptoms, of course, we're just finding that out and ready to take care of them. There are many hospitals in the Boston area, ours included, that actually are testing every woman when they come into labor and delivery to find out whether they have coronavirus or not. And that's really to be able to make sure we're giving them and their baby the best care possible. For the partners or the other support people, they just get asked the questions about symptoms. As long as they're not having symptoms, then they come in and they're here for the time of the delivery. And like I said, I think one of the things that for me, as someone who obviously got into this loving delivering babies, I love the fact that there's so much of the labor floor that is very much the same. Now, for a first-time mom, that won't mean much to you because you haven't been there before. So, but a lot of the ways that things happen on labor and delivery are the same. We're trying to figure out how best to move forward with delivery. We're making sure mom's okay. We're making sure baby's okay. And we have that support person there at the bedside. And then the nurses and doctors are there to answer any questions along the way. So I think once we get past that sort of initial screening part, with the exception of having the masks on, the rest of labor and delivery is very much similar to what it is in when we're not in the middle of something like this.
And is the stay after delivery the same as it would have been before, or has that changed?
It depends on what's going on for the mom and the baby, as always. So we have had many women who are interested in an earlier discharge than what we would usually do, and we've been supporting that to try and, again, help to get people home into a safe environment. But that depends on the fact that the mom and the baby are doing okay. And we actually, early medical discharge was something that we had in the past as well. I think it's just more utilized now because people want to get home. And so depending on whether you had a vaginal delivery or a C-section, and also whether there are any other medical complications, then we sort of assess when both mom and baby are ready to go home. But I would say a much higher percentage of women than usual are choosing to go home kind of on the first day after a vaginal delivery, and then either, which normally they would stay for 2 days, or on the second or third day after a C-section. And that, again, is assuming that everything is going well and we have kind of everything in place for mom and baby to be safe at home.
So we have a little more than a minute left. So I want to ask each of you, and Anika, I'll turn to you on this first. Do you have any advice or words of encouragement for expectant mothers right now?
Well, what I've been trying to do is to just tune out as much negative thoughts as I can and focus on the positive. And even though there's so much uncertainty right now and so much that is unknown, just focusing on the things that I can control, which is staying inside and staying safe and staying healthy, and just thinking about the future and looking forward to my new daughter. No matter what else is going on in the world, we're going to be welcoming a new little life. And so that gives me a lot of hope and encouragement and good feeling, even when I'm feeling worried about everything else.
And actually, Dr. Keimel, no disrespect, but that was a lovely piece of advice, and we're short on clock. So I'm going to end it there. That was Anika Butler, ideas editor for the Boston Globe, who recently wrote an op-ed about being pregnant during the pandemic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Angelique Keimel, maternal fetal medicine specialist and obstetrician gynecologist at Mass General Hospital. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic has been really hard on so many businesses, and one local industry that's been forced to quickly innovate in order to survive is restaurants. Right now, restaurants in Massachusetts are only allowed to offer delivery and takeout, but they've still taken a massive economic hit. The Massachusetts Restaurant Association says that at least 211,000 jobs have already disappeared in the industry, and state restaurants lost an estimated $1.3 billion in April. Many have no idea when they may be able to reopen for full service and what that might even look like. And we're going to talk about that with two local restaurants and ask them how they're handling all of these changes. We also want to hear from you. Are you worried about the survival of your favorite restaurants and bars? What are they? Are you still ordering takeout and delivery from them? And what's that been like? And interestingly, I really want to know, what will it take to get you back into a restaurant for a sit-down meal? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Here to help us have this conversation is Tim Athanasiades. Tim, did I do that right, Athanasiades?
Very good.
Thank you, owner of Asperia Grill in Brighton. I know I've said it before, Tim, but I always struggle a little bit. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And Nia Grace, proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in the South End. Nia, also, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tim, listen, when we last spoke over a month ago, it was just after the colleges had closed down. Students were a big part of your business, and you were worried about whether you'd have any business at all. Now, a lot has changed since then. Restaurants are forced to close table service but can do other parts of the work. How are you operating now, and how's it going?
We have seen a surge. In other words, we've seen a rise in our sales. In the beginning, it was very difficult. Nobody knew where this thing was going, what direction it was heading at. But I think people now are finally starting to branch out. I think everybody's starting to feel a little bit more comfortable eating out. A lot of people are done cooking at home. You know what I'm saying? Enough is enough.
Yes.
So, you know, we're very grateful to the patrons of Asperia. And I just hope it keeps going upwards all the time. We're still down. I mean, we're nowhere near what we used to be. We used to do a decent lunch crowd, and we used to be packed at dinner time. Obviously, that's gone. But I feel that some of our customers who used to come in for dinner are part of that takeout and delivery business. So I'm optimistic, I'm grateful, and I'm glad to tell you that we're better than when we spoke last time.
I'm glad to hear that. Nia, like Tim, you're also doing takeout and delivery, but you have this added dimension of being both a restaurant and a bar. So what does business look like at Darryl's right now? How much staff do you have on and how's it going?
Yeah, we also took that same turn in doing takeout, but with the piece of being a bar, we lost 90% of our income. We also not only do bar service, but we're also live entertainment, and so a lot of that really requires obviously in-person activity. And so with that change, we had to lay off 87%, almost 90% of our workforce. We're on a very, very lean team. We operate mm-hmm. only Friday through Sunday, and we had to limit our hours and even change our menu.
Let me ask you both. Closure now is likely to last really at least through May. The next big hash mark for the governor is May 18th, but that's really the date that his advisory board will deliver a report to him and a set of recommendations about how to reopen. How long can each of you survive with just takeout and delivery?
Who's going first?
Go ahead, Tim. Tim, go ahead.
If the sales stay the way we are now, I will be okay. I have most of my staff here, with the exception of the wait staff. Everybody else is working. Said it before, and I'll say it again. As long as I can pay my bills, I have no problem keeping everyone here, and I'm very grateful. I did get that PPP assistance, so I'm going to make sure that all of that money goes to these kids.
And that's the personal paycheck program?
Yes.
I'm sorry, the
SBA administration yeah. was graceful enough to help little guys like me. So therefore, I'd say for the next 10 weeks, I should be just fine.
But Nia, interestingly, so Tim talked about using this PPP loan program, and we did a segment on that. I think it was last week here on Radio Boston. But that program didn't make sense for you. What's different about your business that it didn't?
So with the PPP, as we understand it, from the day that you receive the loan, you have 8 weeks to rehire your workforce, essentially to the amount that you had before the crisis began, in order to have that piece forgiven. And for most small business owners like myself, I would say that, you don't really want another loan on top of any other bills that you have, especially in a moment where you had to defer a lot of payments. For us, where we're also, sitting on a product of alcohol, we can't do anything. The further back the opening of our state, the further we just have to kind of sit and wait and see what we're going to be able to do. So for us, the PPP is hope. We're hopeful that we'll be able to use it, but there's no guarantee that we're going to be able to use it for what they probably intended it for initially.
And just to be clear for listeners, that's the Paycheck Protection Program, and it's money that allows you to keep people on payroll, and you don't have to pay it back if you keep a certain ratio of it on payroll over a period of time, just to be clear. I'd like to get a call in here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Mark on the line from Milford. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
Well, thanks.
Fine, Mark. How are you?
Hi. Good, thank you. Yeah, it's funny because I listen to you guys all the time, and when you asked that question, the answer came into my head so quickly, it wasn't even something to even think about, and I called right away. But the only
way... What was the question?
About what it would take to get me back to my favorite restaurant or bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would, and the only way I would go back in is if I had a vaccine. Other than that, being in my early 70s, I just don't have. It just scares me half to death. The thought about, especially the people that are asymptomatic and whatnot, and I didn't want to live off my golden years on a respirator.
Mark, what's the restaurant you would go back to if there were a vaccine?
Oh, if there was a vaccine, my favorite restaurant's in Newport, the Black Pearl. I don't get into Boston that much. by summer in Rhode Island, and then I've got my local haunts here in Milford. But at the end of the day, I just have to be assured that, you know, I could survive my favorite meal.
Yeah, Mark, I appreciate the honest answer. Nia, I heard some sounds from you. I can't imagine that hearing that is easy. So let me invite your reaction.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's not easy at all. And I feel the same way. You know, there will be the ones who are like, you know, we need vaccine in order to come back out. And then they're going to be the ones who are going to try it, but it's just going to be a phase for us. So it hurts because, you know, we miss our customers, but that is truly the reality. And so for even if we are to open up May 18th or if it's June 1st, I don't see customers really returning, you know, even at half capacity until maybe August or September. I see that we have a road ahead of us with this.
So this is one of the things that I've wondered, and I invite both of you to answer this. I imagine that there's a certain capacity you have to hit to have it be worth rehiring wait staff and sort of ramping up to have people sitting in the restaurant again. How do you make that calculation? How do you know when it makes sense to reopen that portion of your business, given what we did just hear from a caller like Mark? Tim, maybe you can start.
Sure. For me, we need to know what the rules are, first of all, when we get to that level. And if it's 25%, like they said, that would be just 11 seats for me. So financially, it's not feasible for me to go that way. I would have to wait until we can do at least, I don't know, 50, 75% seating capacity, where how do you get people to be comfortable at that? Otherwise, it's just not going to work. You know, we need to know what exactly we have to do once they say, okay, open your doors for sit down. And it's really difficult to answer that question. But again, it has to be financially, you know, there to take care of a certain amount of people so you can turn over, a profit.
Listeners, yeah. We're talking about restaurants, what it will take for them to survive, which restaurants you most want to give a shout out to and try to keep open during this pandemic. Call in support of your restaurant, in support of Tim and Nia. What are your thoughts about how we keep restaurant businesses going as we find our way through this new normal? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nia, go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with Tim that we absolutely need to know what the guidelines are going to be in order for us to come up with a sound calculation. I will say that I know that the, you know, Massachusetts Restaurant Association is pushing forward with, you know, things that have been given by the CDC in terms of social distancing, 6 feet, you know, having the appropriate signage, not really trying to reduce capacity by a percentage, but more so letting each venue make sure that they're responsible for that 6 feet of social distancing guideline when we get to that point. And so that you can try to find it to be fruitful for you. For us, we won't know again either, but I know that if we had to reduce our capacity by 50%, we would have only 7 tables in the restaurant, and that wouldn't be something that we could survive off of nightly.
Correct.
I want to ask you both, in Georgia, they do have guidelines. We don't have them yet in Massachusetts. The guidelines for restaurants that want to reopen, there are 39 of them. At what point is it complicated enough to take that part of your business back open again that you just remain takeout focused, for a very long period of time because the guidelines are so much to have to do?
Yeah, I think that, for us, the 39 bullets, if it's 40, if it's 50, that's really cumbersome. A big piece of our business is the intimacy and the interaction amongst guests. For us, we're also a very small, we're a pretty tiny venue. We got a lot of, oomph, but at the same time, having a band and then having the guests, it kind of makes the entire experience impossible. And I think now we're faced with, do we try to preserve, the how do we preserve the business and preserve our images and preserve, you know, the experience and the history that people are used to from us at this point. So it will be hard for us, I think, to come out in that phase one of a plan. It might be phase two or three. And that's really if we make it to that point.
Let's grab another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian's on the line from Stowe. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Hi. Go ahead.
It's my first time on the radio, I guess.
Go ahead, Brian. What'd you call for?
I just give a special thanks to Kennedy's Pub in Marlboro.
Is that the one that you most want to try to keep open?
Yeah, that's my favorite lunch spot. And I noticed they've been doing renovations during the close time, so maybe it'll be something new when it opens.
So, Brian, they're not offering any takeout or carry-out service of any kind right now. They're fully shut down.
I'm not sure. They have a marketplace out front, so I go there for lunch.
So
the market is still open. Yeah, the market's still open.
Got it. Thanks for that call and for the shout-out. Kennedy's, we're thinking of you. Tim, we heard Nia say it before. Brian implied it. There's a community to your local restaurant, to your local pub. How do we keep that sense of community and dining out together when we're bringing the food home?
I believe that the number one thing we need to do is get people to be comfortable of coming in and sitting down. But the restaurant experience is the one that when you go there, you know, the mingling is a part of it. Obviously, the great food and they have a nice glass of wine or a nice cold beer. But, you know, serving 10 people in a restaurant that usually serves about, you know, 44 people isn't going to cut it. But what we need to do now is focus on getting people to come in and to be relaxed and enjoy that meal and get that atmosphere that we had before this happened. That's what I believe.
Nia, how about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, getting the customer to be comfortable is one thing, but also even the staff. I don't know, you know, what everyone else is going through, but I imagine that staffing is going to be harder. We'd already experienced it where we even had just a few positions that we could offer and our staff was scared to come out, and rightfully so. And so, you know, we have to try to kind of quell those fears on both sides. But I think a concern for us, too, is when do we, I think for me, it's about some of the other businesses who don't even have an opportunity to do the takeout. What's going to happen to those businesses? You know,
Nia, we're going to take some more calls now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Caleb on the line from Mashpee. Caleb, go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to call in and say that I'm looking forward to getting back to the Raw Bar over at the Inn at Pompanesset. They got some killer lobster rolls, so as soon as they can figure out how to let us eat outside and keep our distance from everyone else, I'll be heading over there.
Hey, Caleb, stay for a second. Does the outside factor matter to you? Would you be more likely to do a sit-down restaurant that has outside seating than go into a building, or does it not matter? Is it social distancing either way for you?
I would feel much more comfortable for a place that has outdoor seating. And I think a lot of places up here on the Cape are, you know, have a little bit of an advantage on that because you can keep a little bit more distance between people. You don't have to worry about squeezing behind tables and things like that.
Thanks for that call, Caleb. You know, Tim, is there physical setup that you can play with that may allow you to invite diners back in a way that makes them more comfortable?
I think social distancing now is in everyone's mind. Unless we actually build booths with plexiglass for every table at this point in time, which I you know, that's not a road I want to go down on. But to invite people in, everybody needs to feel, you know, there's enough distance between them and the next table, and also the person, the wait staff that's going to wait on them as well. I mean, do they need to be wearing gloves, masks? Again, it goes back to what are the rules when we get to that level. And I have to agree with Nia that, you know, even before this hit, that help was incredibly hard to find. And now I believe it's going to be even more difficult. So we have challenges ahead of us, and time will tell. I hope we get through this, and I hope it's quick, but I think it's going to be around for a little while longer.
That's Tim Athanasiadis, the owner of Asperia Grill in Brighton, and Nia Grace, proprietor and general manager of Daryl's Corner Bar and Kitchen in the South End. I appreciate you both coming back today, and we'll be thinking about you and rooting for your businesses as we go forward.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you become sick with COVID-19, federal health officials advise you to stay home in one room, separated from any other people. That's difficult for anyone, but imagine what happens if you live with someone else in a one-bedroom Boston apartment with just one bathroom. WBUR's Shira Springer has the story of Jeff Harvey and Dana Hindman.
We love it. I mean, it's a great location. It's, you know, in the heart of South Boston.
That's Dana Hindman describing the apartment where she lives with boyfriend Jeff Harvey.
Jeff's actually been living here for 5 years
now. Just about 5 years, yeah.
And I moved in almost 2 years ago.
And when Dana tested positive for COVID-19 in late March, she stayed in the 900-square-foot apartment with Jeff. He never thought of going anywhere else.
I don't think it would have made sense with the way our apartment is and just... I wouldn't want to just leave her alone either when she's going through that.
Living with Dana, Jeff had prolonged exposure to the virus. He figures he was probably positive but asymptomatic. Meanwhile, Dana struggled with many of the familiar COVID-19 symptoms. Shortness of breath, body aches, and...
I had pretty severe chest pain that was pretty debilitating. I mean, it was really scary. It felt like nothing I had ever felt before. And then this nasty cough that was really, debilitating and uncomfortable.
Dana described her symptoms as mild, but then she said that the chest pain wrapped around her body from back to front and felt like a constant weight on her lungs. There were too many sleepless nights to count and long days filled with fatigue. And the emotional ups and downs of the virus proved equally tough to handle. Through it all, Jeff was there as caretaker, doing whatever he could to help.
There would be times where... there was some hope where she was getting a little bit, she felt like she was getting better, but, and then all of a sudden it was just like back to square one, like it, this, like just the coronavirus was just as bad as it had been day one. And so that kind of, that emotional roller coaster just kind of got to me as well.
Most days, Dana would lie on the living room couch while Jeff sat nearby and worked from home at his job in finance. And even though they spent all day together, it wasn't always easy to know what Dana needed.
Jeff may not have a lot of medical knowledge, but he's been a support system in my life for, you know, 4+ years, and I can't imagine going at this alone. So I think that's been the biggest thing for me.
A lot of extra hugs throughout the day, too.
A lot of hugs.
With her on the couch, just coming over, giving her a little cuddle for a minute or two.
Yeah.
I think that's helped, hopefully.
So did riding out the coronavirus together in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment make them closer, make them a stronger couple?
Everything like this, you know, makes people stronger. But I feel like we were pretty strong going into this anyway. So I don't know. I guess we'll see when we come out of it, right?
Dana still has a lingering cough, but she's come out of the worst of it. Last week, Dana returned to work as a physical therapist. She's out of the apartment and treating COVID-19 patients now, helping some of the severest cases regain mobility. She knows what her patients have experienced, and she has a good idea what it's been like for their caretakers, too.
That from WBUR's Shira Springer.